So the condition under which low browness, gentlemen, and progress in this country has come to the common man is, or what you call democracy, you can call it with various names, is very severe discipline. The discipline is that everybody has to keep going. That is, he has to turn on the radio. He has to listen to Mr. Eisenhower's speech, or at least to Elizabeth Taylor's speech. And perhaps you listen to Debbie too. This, what these gentlemen from the press know so very well, this being kept posted, this getting on, is a very strict discipline. It is very strange that it is never discussed, even not by the psychologists of this country. They all try to have private patients, but the country itself would immediately go insane if at any one moment this constant influx of the next idea would be stopped. I want to bring home to you the fact that you can every day live arbitrarily, but the sequence of these days is not arbitrary. You think you are free to think today this, to interest this, that's all right. But the fact of the matter is that in this country, with the election campaigns and with the incredible novelty of the situation, geographically and political and otherwise and socially, the march of events, the cavalcade as it has been also called, there are many words, you see, the march of time, you have all these words of big movement, that the movie theater of events forces upon the mind a constant flux, a perpetual renewal of his representations, of his concepts, of his vision, of his, what is in his mind. Don't believe for a minute that because you say I'm independent and free, that you are. The pictures that cross your mind, and you usually cross out your reason, blind you. They are the flashlights of the daily news, or the flashlight of the daily impression, or whatever it is. In any case, the American public is treated to sensations. Now the professional man is so boring because he may have to look at the same tree for a whole lifetime and count the rings, you know. That's a very boring performance. Now, as we read the papers, we hear that here Forrester does this experiment with the longevity of a tree and discusses, then you read about the pyramids, then you read about excavation of the Sinanthropos, of the oldest skull in China, and on it goes. There is no end to the novelties that press on your brain. That's a typical attitude of the public. The public is, in this country, more disciplined than in any other, because it is ritual that you go to the movies three times, that you know of the next movie, you decide from hearsay whether to go there or not. Now, you have to be in the race. What Made Sammy Run was a book which a boy from my college wrote with great success in Hollywood, and he's still here. You know, the books is always forgotten again. What Made Sammy Run? Eh? Who wrote it? Of course. And I thought it was a horrible book. But you know, teachers usually don't think much of their students. But the phrasing I thought was so inhuman. But that's the idea, you see. Running. And usually you're chasing your own tail. You cannot in this country recall to a public audience what they saw to hear go. That's an insult. They tell me that when, 50 years ago, when you came to California and you asked a man who was his grandfather, he would shoot you. That was an insult. Probably it wasn't very pleasant to know who the grandfather was. Now, that has disappeared. You don't shoot people for their grandfather, but you do shoot a man if you tell him that he was a McCarthy man in 1948. See, that's no longer fashionable. He won't shoot you, but he won't talk to you, and he will not hear it. You just will deny it. And there is a strange faculty in the public to forget what it thought. If you read Shakespeare The mob in Julius Caesar, when they stone Cinna, the poet, you remember? They burn him. Obviously, next day, not one of these people would remember that they ever did such a thing. All these good people who lynch people in the South for the last 100 years, of course, have never known anything of it the next day. The forgetfulness, gentlemen, of a crowd that comes together for one new information or one new stimulus is a remarkable feature. But it is inherent in the organization of a society in which we keep recognizing each other by the tie of the day, by the fashion. And whereas the French have created the physical fashion for the ladies, America has created the mental fashion for men. And that, since it is invisible, this deification of the mind in movement, that is unheard of in the history of the world. And it, of course, destroys everything we call the people. Because people are of long memory, are immune against immediate stimuli, are quite indifferent to what the world says about the education of their children, and laughs when the child comes home and says, "Mother, we must now have a television set." This country was built up in the 18th century, as you know, by non-conformists, by people who were proud when they could say to their child, "We don't do this, because all the neighbors do it." Now, I ask you how it is possible with the pressure of the schools on every household today that parents really get through this. They are just blackmailed by there's an extortionist movement on foot by the children against their parents, with the simple reasoning everybody else does. Now you shake your head, lady, you say that isn't true?
It is true.
Yes, you say. Well, wonderful. We have one non-conformist in the hall. I congratulate you. You saved the country. This is a very serious business. I know, of course, that the people of this country have taken an energetic stand against this. But the official American, as seen from the outside for the last 100 years, gentlemen, is the lowbrow, the man who is interested in every new idea and every new invention and every new discovery, until the next. You will know very well how the newspapers drop a bomb, and next day you can't find it in the paper. You're desperate. You are so interested. Well, they are interested in the next thing. And that has never, if you read an English paper that's very much stated, say something important happened, you can follow it up. Impossible here. Never is mentioned again. You must know that this is a specific feature because history makes no sense if it doesn't enable you to understand the specific and particular character of a nation, or of a new world, as this really is. This is much more than one nation. And it is this character that, after 1850, was pronounced. It was already in action, of course, developing before. I'll give you a funny story. John Quincy Adams was president of the United States, and there was a lady journalist in Washington going around and trying to improve her very bad finances by getting sensational news. So one day he was swimming in the Potomac all by himself, with his clothes on the river bank, when suddenly he saw that a lady, or what should I say, a woman, was sitting on these clothes and said, "If you don't give me an interview, you can't get into your clothes." And since he was absolutely naked as Adam, he had to grant the interview, and she could improve her financial status, and then he was allowed to go home, the President of the United States. So the publicity, you see, is already at that time in the 20s of the 19th century in full bloom. You couldn't have done this to George Washington. That's the difference. It wouldn't have existed. The means, there wouldn't have existed this kind of code. Nobody would have dared to do this. And so there is a very distinct break in the tradition of this country when all this was became natural and became important. What I try to say at this moment is the word discipline. The discipline of a democracy is a very severe one, and I sometimes think it is much more severe than anything we had in Europe ever. What you call militarism, feudalism, royalty, was much more relaxing and much less disciplined than you have under the law of publicity. The publicity is absolutely pitiless. Once you get into the clutches of publicity here in this country, you well know that you are drowned till there is really not even chaff left, let alone the grain of wheat. And this merciless right of the public to participate for the moment in anything that happens now is the eminent feature which every other nation, I think, will always attribute to this country. The severe discipline of the public person to have his bowels photographed when they are operated upon. And it is only now I come to the consequence. You all pride yourselves that in this country you are closer to nature. I deny it. I think this country is once in a very artificial situation, which I do not in any way criticize, because I think it's an important and inevitable function among the people of the world that one nation should bear the brunt of the slogan for all and everybody. This publicity means that a news, an invention, a fact has to come to everybody. And there is this definite office that in one nation this comes first and all the other interests of the few, even of the many and even of the one, take second seat. It is this all right as long as we belong to as a member to a group of nations in which these other offices are allowed to function. That's one condition. And it is wholesome if you are aware that any one of these floodlights of the day are heretical. That not one of them is without its danger when you take it for the end. Take the McCarthy story. It wasn't dangerous in itself that at one time people should expurgate this communist invasion from this country. It only becomes important or dangerous if this is then the new face of the country, you see, the fanaticism and the annihilation of any opponent to whom you can paste the name of communist or our fellow traveler. The exaggeration is incredible. I think the McCarthy business is an interesting story because when the man died, he was forgotten. He was already forgotten when he died. And so you must understand that the discipline in democracy is that out of the 365 heresies under the sun, all 365 have their day in court, none can be absolute. That's why I think the situation of minority rights in this country is of such first importance. The majority would at any one moment try to overrule and override, you see, all exceptions. But since we know already by bitter experience that one day later they would repent it, you see, the Marshall, the Constitution has introduced certain inhibitions beyond which Congress cannot go. And that was invented as this country rolled along. The fathers of this Constitution, in 1787, the Federalists, hadn't thought of that. As you know, Marshall's intervention was completely new when he passed the decision that the United States Congress could not be sovereign in the sense of an arbitrary monarch, you see, of a despot. This was a discovery, and therefore it belongs to the social history of the United States, because it has to do with the conviction of the majority or of all people at any one moment. I gave you the figures for prohibition. I showed you that 4/5 of all the legislative bodies of the United States, you see, in their votes, remember the figures, voted in 1920 for prohibition. And 15 years later, it was not left on the books. The story of this amendment, it's the 18th, isn't it? The 18th Amendment may explain to you that I'm speaking here of real bitter experiences of this country. That as of the moment, you see, any opinion or any feeling will hold sway over this country. But that you know already that there are 364 other days in the year, and an other feeling will come to the fore. And if you would prevent this, we would go all insane. Because any one of these feelings, opinions, and convictions exaggerated and carried to its bitter end, we would destroy this republic. This, I think, is an important insight. The kaleidoscope of democracy lives by its completeness. Once you stop this wheel turning, you see, the country will find itself I won't use too strong words, but it certainly is a medical case. And unfortunately, as yet, we have no psychoanalysts for the nations. I myself have written a serious book, it's a lifetime work, a psychoanalysis of the different nations of the world, called Out of Revolution, and the autobiography of Western men. I think we will have to consider very seriously whether the nations are not really the centers of our complexities. I don't think that psychoanalysis is doing a good job because it deals with the individual. But what is in our minds is not of our own making. That has much larger, you see, complex institutional origins and destinies. I think the nations need much more to be analyzed than those individuals. And I'm very serious in this. I think the harm done and the money spent on psychoanalysis in private matters is just an absurdity of the bourgeois age of the 19th century, which has come to this country belatedly, because all these mental fashions of Europe come here belatedly. When it was already unnecessary in Europe, it has come to this country. It is the last stand taken by the bourgeois class in its disintegration. But it is a much more serious proposition that nations can be mentally stuck and have repressions. And I think in this country, the repression for which an historian is meant to act as an antidote, your repression is that you use the word nature and natural where it doesn't belong, for your own character. The American character is a highly complicated character, an historical character with a definite function in the Christian tradition, and you deny, so to speak, your powers and your way of outgrowing or enlarging on your position if you think that what you call the American is the natural man. He's a man who has come from Europe and found that the one and the few and the manyness of the constitution of that continent could be supplemented by an order in which we first think of everybody before we think of one. And that's all elect the president is just the symbol, so to speak, of this indifference to the one, the order of the one. If I had more time, I would show you that the fear of anarchy in other countries has been such that people thought they couldn't even find one ruler. And therefore, kingship was considered, the best, because it was a miracle that anyone could rule a crowd. If you wait another 10 years in this country, you will have come to the same dead end, that it will be impossible to find a proper candidate for the presidency. Because our states have lost their independence, the individual states. It isn't very much to be governor of a state at this moment, so that's not a good step for the presidency. The wars, there will be no war probably in the next 20 years, so Mr. Eisenhower will not, or Mr. Grant, or George Washington, or General Taylor, or General Tyler, they can have no way of proving themselves or Jackson. And so where shall they come from? From the Rand Corporation? Well, this is very serious. We have at this moment no competitive system, you see, for the candidacy of for political office of any scope. I mean, Mr. Parson may be very nice, I love him for driving a Rambler, but that isn't good enough for preparing anybody for president. And this is serious. And you must perhaps allow me to state these things, because for the last 10 years, for the last 15 years, America has seen the limitations of its stand for all. The fall, the great, profound fall of this country was, of course, when the bomb was nationalized. All inventions belong to mankind. When Mr. Otto Hahn in Berlin in 1938 discovered the fission of uranium, he published it in a scientific journal and without any seclusion. And as you know, the Germans never built the bomb. But in this country, the military has tried to taint the record of America, which has always been liberal and generous with its inventions for all foreign people, and has withheld the bomb. That's impossible. It's already, I think, today understood after the change in the administration of the Atomic Energy Commission that this was a great mistake, that England and France and everybody should have known right away what it was all about. And this is very ghastly. It's a fall. That's how the fall of Adam and Eve always looks in our own days. You don't notice it. The character of the fall is always that people are convinced that this is within their rights, but it was a sin against the Holy Spirit of this country. And therefore, I dare say that the limitations of the democratic process have been found. It is not possible. I don't know if I wouldn't have acted like Mr. Strauss in 1946. But it is, then that would only mean that it is not possible to function in the way that we have declared to be the American way always. There is a leeway, so to speak, and at times you are driven to a different kind of principle, and it should be admitted. Because otherwise we are not free. We have to follow the bend of our inertia and our nature. And all I have to say at this moment is that my history of society in this country has an immediate bearing on your own amount of freedom. If you do not catch yourself to grow out of the shells of the fetters of the 19th century, I think this country must have a third world war, must go smaller than it is into a mere nation when it is a whole world, and should become even a larger world. And so you, every one of you, in his turning against this truth, which I try to propose, or upholding and spreading it, is deciding whether this country shall be kept small and narrow and bigot, or whether it still has a function in the world at large in the future. Because I can assure you, this system of France, England, Germany and America is of the past. That's all over. We have now Russia, and we have the East, and we have to function in a different setting. And therefore, the boast of being an American is just as childish as the boast of the French, I'm French. Or the Germans, I'm full German, or the English, I'm English. It doesn't work anymore. That's all over. And the sooner we realize over, the more we can keep the precious elements of this, our former office. But you must see that it is a limited fiction, and is only true under a certain constellation. And the constellation is, of course, that the ideas do come from Fontainebleau, Versailles, Paris, Neuilly, Sorcene, all French, American writers wrote their poems and painted their paintings in the last 100 years. Vincent Stephen Bennett wrote his John Brown's Body in Neuilly, Sorcene. And every other French, American writer, as you know, got his inspiration somewhere else. Because to be one in this country was impossible. Herman Melville had expressed it very beautifully in a letter to an English publisher in 1850, and that's therefore the year of decision. He said, let me try to find it. Very beautiful sentence, and I think
you will understand there is no reason to be. He writes to his an English publisher, tries to persuade him to print a book of his in England. "This country, America, is at present engaged in furnishing material for future authors, not in encouraging its living ones." I think that's a masterful sentence, a very proud American sentence. In 1851 it's written, "This country is at present engaged in furnishing material for future authors, not in encouraging its living ones." I think this sentence deserves your attention. Perhaps you take it down. It's written on July 20th, 1851. And so the author of Moby Dick and Pierre has to write to his English publisher, you see, feeling that he cannot expect in America the support of the one, of the single person, of the singular person. Do you understand? "This country is at present engaged in furnishing material for future authors, not in encouraging its living ones." All this you still can realize at this moment, but it was of course infinitely truer 100 years ago. About the discipline of democracy. The second thing I left with you, I tried to leave with you, I'm sure I didn't succeed, is that Emerson is the seed of the liberal arts college in this country. And that his glorious time over his forming, when he ceased to be a minister from 1830, that is, to 1850-56, in 30 years, have made him the outstanding person as the ancestor of all of us here. I wouldn't be here, you wouldn't be here without Walpole Emerson. Because he has changed the schools of this country, who were barren imitations of the English schools, into what we call today a liberal arts college, which doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Now it is again against your grain to be told that a man is the seed of an institution, that he embodies it in advance. I have to fight here your connotation of a man as one among many. Mr. Emerson is not a man among many, because he is the forerunner, the beginner, the embodiment in advance of what we are in the mass. Our 99 departments in this college all have a point of contact within Emerson. This diffusion, this, you can say, anarchy of departments on this campus is already a last, and I think ultimate, and rather threatening, anarchy of an order in which Emerson saw the connections of literature, science, mathematics, poetry, the arts, etc. The liberal arts college in him is the harmony. Whether it is this today, you or every day experience in your own studies. It's a long story to go into this, but the important kernel of the idea is, gentlemen, that you must not think of fruitful men or creative men as people who just then appear in the dictionary of American biography, per se. It's quite the contrary. What they really are appears in the many people who live according to the paths beaten by them. The religious revival in this country was started by a man of whom nobody even knows the name today. His name was Tennant. He came to this country in 1716 from North Ireland, a Scotch Presbyterian, and he founded for his 6 sons and their 8 friends the log cabin in Pennsylvania. And from this log cabin, 14 powerful boys came forth and started the great revival in America. And the men who started the log cabin college, as it was called then, Mr. Tennant, has no place in the dictionary of American biography, but he, of course, was the founder. And that's why he has no place in a world in which only the arrivals see the latest come out. The people who said something to everybody, you see, are known. If he had established, like Bill Graham, religious department store, everybody would know it. So it has in this country, of course, all the important things have also been started from small seeds. But what I ask you to do is to forget even the buildings, to forget that there are walls. Emerson is in you through his spirit, he is in your loins, he is in your body. He has begotten us. This is to be learned from history, how people are begotten. Gentlemen, religion makes faces. The spirit creates races, not the body. You can investigate the hormones for what you want. The human face is a product of what it thinks and speaks, how it prays and at whom it looks. If you look at idols, you will look correspondingly like an idolater. And if you look at the living God, you will have a human face. And faces make races. Perhaps you take this down. And Emerson has created the race of the American college student. And that is a race, quite a one. Faces make races. And we face up to our teacher, and we face up to the classics, and we face up to art, or we face up to science, and accordingly, we see a different world through our eyes. And once the eyes begin to live, and the ears begin to understand, we are different people. If you want to see the contrast between this embodiment, I put Emerson into this box of the infinitude of the private citizen, I guess. That's the way in which he anticipated you and my privilege, you see, to have a civil life, private life of our own during our years of education. Have our library, go to the place we want, you see, buy the books we like. This whole realm of privacy which he has created. And that, of course, compares, if you take this here in our clue, compares to the wild horde of immigrants and pioneers who are on the outside in India, 50, everywhere visible, of whom we have to speak more. Immigrants who know nothing of being a public, who try to remain a people, and pioneers who try to create a people, know nothing of public. But here Emerson, in his suave manner, persuading us that during our formative years, we should be public. We should listen to everything. Because the liberal arts college is, of course, the idealized public. It is the discipline of the public to read the book on the book market that comes out, you see, to be interested in new ideas, to go along with the new play, to go under this discipline of the understanding public who buys a ticket because there is a new artist coming and offering his services. If you want to understand, however, what has kept this country going and today shows it beyond the limitations of this American of 1850, I'll give you the name of Herman Melville. Herman Melville is, on the surface of things, a contemporary of Walt Whitman and even of Emerson. He lived from 1819 to 1891. Perhaps you compare the dates. Emerson, as I remember, when he was born, 1805, isn't it? I gave you this figure. And died in 1882. No, it must be, who has it done? These dates are all very important. I advise you, when you deal with history, always get your dates first straight. They are the skeleton of history. Never neglect them. They are too much despised in this country. But the biographical dates are terribly helpful because they show you how very few people stay alive all their life long. Emerson was, for all practical purposes, dead in 1856. Now, Melville, as you know, is the great tragic figure of American literature. Just as Walt Whitman is the big humbug of American literature. And they are contemporaries, even in a more severe sense. Walt Whitman is born in 1819, and he died in 1892. So they really overlap completely. Now, you may know that from 1851 to 1927, you could not buy the Melville's Pier. For all practical purposes, it didn't exist. It was the first edition after the first edition, which was a failure and didn't sell, in 1927. Yet Herman Melville is the American who, from the very first, belongs to more than the 19th century. He belongs as well to the 21st century as to the 17th. And that's why I think he is the most important American. He's not the greatest American, I don't say this, but he is the most important American, because you can see here that you are all wrong when you think that a human being, it must be a contemporary of his contemporaries. The greatness of a man is measured by the amount of distemporaneity which he can bear. To be a contemporary is very, very little. Anybody who is a real human being is as much connected with some time before him and some time after him. In which way? I mean, through children or parents, that's one thing. Through books or through laws or through memories or through services, that's another. A soldier who today serves in the United States Army certainly is connected with 1776. He can't have it. He does support the creation that Dr. Mutt started there. So to be a soldier means to reach out for more than in one's own generation. And if you die on the battlefield, all the more so, because the meaning of your destiny is only contained in the next generation to follow. We talked about this in the beginning. Now, Herman Melville is the soldier of the spirit who has embodied, who has lived, and has lived deliberately, this lack of interest in the contemporary scene. Since you think that authors have to be measured by the sale of their books, at least that's what they officially tell us all the time, and that if a book is a failure, he can't be a great genius, I must warn you, Melville is the glowing protest against this nonsense. The fewer people read a book in the beginning, the more probable it is that it's a very important book. When I read the criticism of Melville in your English department textbooks and so on, I'm always appalled by his insidious and insipid attempt to place this man in the year 1851 or in 1870. There's a book, I'm afraid to say, by a very good man in this country, that's why I won't give his name, which tries to make Mr. Melville an appendix of the literary movement of the 50s in New York City. That's appalling. You see, that's an attempt to make genius a member of the logos, to deal him as all. For the all and the discipline of everybody, the day and the contemporaneity of the idea do exist. It is obvious that as far as I am not a scientist myself, I have to take notice of the new discovery of the 2.5 minutes which it takes to send radar to the Venus from the papers. And I'm only participating with this little bit of information in the progress of science, am I not? And therefore I have to turn to the next. When somebody else invents something, I again want to say, know something about plant life, I want to know something about stones, I want to know something of the Navy, and so I keep going. So with regard to my 23 hours a day stupidity, or interest in general affairs, I am obviously dependent on my being a contemporary. For Mr. Everybody is the man of the day. And every one of us is Mr. Everybody. There is nobody who can exclude him from this. But with regard to the specific contribution which somebody makes who devotes himself to Laura Bridgman or Helen Keller for a lifetime to make these people see and hear, today has absolutely nothing to offer. They are not contemporaries of anything. And every one of us, and especially the women gentlemen in this country, have to rescue these other officers of the spirit. Any woman is selective and says, this one and nobody else. If she says everybody else, you know what she is. Selection, which means all the higher stages of the spiritual life. Selectivity goes by degrees, it is true. But Hermann Melville was absolutely uncompromising. And I may perhaps give you one sentence of fame from the famous sermon from Moby Dick. There's a great sermon, as you may recall. Who has not read Moby Dick, by the way?
Oh, Your Highness.
Would you do it? Please do. Yeah, I may ask a question in the examination.
Thank you, Mr. One second.
I will. I take it for granted that nobody can go to college who hasn't read Moby Dick and still knows what he knows. That's of course more than you really do. Father Mackey gives a sermon on Jonah. And he says, and that is very much what Melville said in his letters to Hawthorne himself. Woe to him who seeks to please rather than to appall. Now that's hard doctrine. And perhaps you take this sentence down because there you have the constant paradox of in any democracy, which lives by public. Public is a peace bill who don't have to listen, who are not a captive audience, who can go home and don't buy the ticket. Now if you start everything, every truth, every movement, from pleasing the public, you can't go right. You must go wrong. Yet our whole society is organized on this principle. And somebody in this audience has said to me, oh, in education we had a bias model. This was told, said to me 4 weeks ago. I can assure you that in all my life, I began teaching when I was 13 years old, I've never thought of the teaching and learning proposition in terms that even would have made me understand the term buyer's market and seller's market in education. Because education means to tell somebody something what he doesn't know. So there can be no buyer's market. Because the child is ignorant. And to please him and to try to persuade him that he has made the choice is one of the silliest things in this country, which I can meet with now, that people of 5 or 7 or 12 or 13 are allowed to say whether they would like to take mathematics or English or whatnot. It's just insanity. Absolute insanity. That's why there will never be any education in this country as long as we have these superintendents of schools who think that they are just selling their product. Show them all out. Education is not a process of selling anything. What is teaching? Why do I teach you this? You see, I have to teach you all the things which I have not been able to carry out in my life. To teach is for every living generation the remainder of the things undone yet. Therefore, all teaching is prophetic. All teaching is a witness, testimonial to the fact that I employ you to do what I have not been able to do. That's teaching. Nothing else. You know some things have to be done forever or they have to be done in the future, so you teach them because you can't do it all what has to be done. Teaching is
intimately connected with deeds, because it is make sure that the deeds are followed up which already have been done. That's what teaching is. And you speak of skills and all these infinite, infamous, ignominious sales problems. The degradation of education in this country is complete because the people who dedicate themselves to the profession of education don't know what it is. Now, this has to do with Hermann Mill. The man was forgotten because he didn't sell. You see, it was a buyer's market. Now, obviously, men like Melville did not cater to the public. And he says in so many words already in his earliest youth that he wouldn't, that he preferred to be a failure than to cater to the public. And therefore, this very cruel sentence, and I know it is cruel, I want you to take down literally. Woe to him who seeks to please rather than to appall. The child has to be frightened out of his wits what happens if it doesn't. But that goes for everything. Woe to him who in this world courts not dishonor. Woe to him whose good name is more to him than goodness. Whose good name is more to him than goodness. Now, I'm trying to show you that the world is held together only by the people who are not totally sunk in their own time. That's why the life of Jesus cannot be written, you see, because the whole principle of the existence of Jesus in his own lifetime was that he did not count into his own time. That he only came to the beginning of his workmanship as a vision of ecstasy after his death. That's called the resurrection. They express it in different terms, but you can express it in terms of contemporaneity and distemporaneity. Jesus is a complete distemporary because not even one of his apostles understood him at the time of his life. Peter betrayed him. So distemporaneity, gentlemen, is the heritage of the Christian era. That a man is as more important for the continuity of history, the more he is able to be indifferent to the agreeableness of his contemporaries. And therefore, you should have the courage to say that Hermann Melville broke out of the march of events and therefore is today the most important American of the 19th century. For this very reason, that you can, why? He comes from Shakespeare in the Bard. He read this, and he read it in the most fortunate, privileged position of reading it when he was 25. That is, after the Dulcineas of the Sunday School had done their work. So it wasn't sweet. It was very harsh reading, like as the sermon on Jonah shows, you see. He read the Bible when it should be read. If I could pass a law, I would pass a law that nobody is allowed to read the Bible before he's 40. The only way in which it can recover, so to speak, from its abuse as Pepsi-Cola. Because the Bible is written to give us the power not to be contemporaries. That's all it's written for. That's the whole meaning of the Bible. Don't be contemporary, be prophetic. That's why there is a prophet. Backward and forward, we have to keep the contact with all times, or we are not saving men from a deep, profound fall. Melville, of course, proved this because he was the only man not surprised by the Civil War in his heart. Mankind did not change because the Civil War broke out. People didn't, so to speak, look suddenly different, you see, from being angels now being devils. Walt Whitman, the prophet of optimism, was completely sainted when the war broke out. Didn't know for 2 years what it was all about. The same with Emerson. They all had to make a complete readjustment because their naive, optimistic phase of 1850, of course, went to pieces. The only man who had nothing to take back and nothing to add to his insight into the secrets of this country is Hermann Mesmer. You find in Mardin, which is written in 1849, already a clear delineation of the limitations of democracy in this country. Why it is good, and how far it can go, and how far it cannot go. The book Mardin is probably unknown to you. Who has read Mardin? That's all. Oh, poor Mesmer. He, only to show you that there is a very clear path, here we have the Christian people and the Bible and Shakespeare bear witness to this victory over the moment which any people constitutes, the indifference to the passions of the day. Then you get the public in 1850, all the fashionable things of the mind, let them in and get under their discipline. Today, as you know, we have not only the fission of the apple, but we have for the last 100 years as a revolt against the private citizen and the individual, the disintegration of the individual, the real problem of psychoanalysis, of labor, of juvenile delinquency, of the mass, you see, mass spirit of the mass media, is that we are less than individuals. We are disintegrated. We have a nervous breakdown. We are split personalities. This country, as you know, has the highest rate of schizophrenics all over the world. Why is that so? Because it is impossible to be an individual. Nobody can stand the strain. You either integrate into a people or you fall down and split into many fragments. Now, this fragmentation is the content of Melville's second great book of Care. Moby Dick is Shakespeare and the Bible renewed for America. And Pierre is the anticipation of Freud and all the problems of our day, 100 years ahead of time, the ambiguity. That we all are at least two people is the content of Pierre. That we are not an individual, that nobody can be. That's why it is called the ambiguity. And that's why you should all read it. It's a very difficult book. And the author went to pieces over it, and the Encyclopedia Britannica has a very interesting statement on this man Melville. He says, they say there in this article on Melville that the books he wrote, beginning with Pierre, seem to be written by another author. Now that's strong language. Now our literary men, my dear ladies and gentlemen, are sacrifices, and Melville is the sacrifice, the victim of America. And he was sacrificed so that one person. Oh.